Homestyle Green, episode 234. What are the business opportunities of building sustainably? G'day, welcome back to another episode of Homestyle Green. This is the podcast dedicated to inspiring people to make a better place to live. My name is Matthew Cutler-Welsh, and this week on the show, I'm very pleased to bring you an interview I had recently with Dr. Robert Shrouf. Dr. Robert Shrouf is the Murrin Chair of Global Competitiveness at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh. He's a Professor of Sustainability, Operations and Supply Chain Management in the Sustainable Business Practices MBA program, and as the Curriculum Lead for Sustainability within the Palumbo Donohue School of Business, Dr. Robert Shrouf has helped this innovative program become the number one ranked MBA Sustainable Business Practice program in the US. Dr. Shrouf's Sustainability Tools and Processes for New Initiatives course became one of just 20 elected internationally by the Aspen BSP as one of the Ideas Worth Teaching Award winners. The Production and Operations Management Society, along with the Academy of Management, have also acknowledged Dr. Shrouf's thought leadership and teaching. He's the author of a number of books, the most recent publication being The Power of Existing Buildings, Save Money, Improve Health, and Reduce Environmental Impacts, which explains why existing buildings can and should be retrofitted to reduce environmental impacts that contribute to climate change while improving human health and productivity for building occupants. It's a step-by-step guide that would challenge readers to rethink spaces where people work and play while determining how existing buildings can help ultimately save the world. It was a great pleasure to be introduced to Dr. Shrouf, and I'm very pleased to bring you this interview today. Thank you very much for joining us on the Homestyle Green podcast. Now, before we get into homes, let's talk a little bit more about your background, and that's been more in the area of supply chain and sustainability in that field. Is that a good summary of your studies and research?
Yeah, a lot of that background started with environmental management systems and operations management, which is a part of sustainable supply chain management. So yeah, that's where I'm coming from in terms of a business professor and my approach to this. And then I was co-opted into the green building movement by a lot of people here in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania that were part of this at the Green Building Alliance and other professionals that I invited into my classroom as speakers to help better inform business students about the opportunities that green buildings provide.
What does sustainability mean for you, and how do you teach the concept of sustainability?
Yeah, it's a great question because it's such a broad concept and there's so much going on. So I think we go back to the Brundtland definition in 1987 saying that it's meeting the needs of a current generation without compromising the needs of future generations. And then with that broad kind of uber concept, we can then go into a strategic sustainable development framework. So I can define and operationalize sustainability for any organization based on what that organization does. If they're a manufacturer, a service provider, we can even morph this into a building and defining sustainability for a building. It would start with understanding the systems in which we operate. That's the top end of the five-level framework. Then defining what is success for this when going forward, looking at then how it would be strategic. And from that being strategic, we'd actually look at then breaking out from this, what actions can we take and what tools can we support this decision analysis with. So those are the five levels of the framework. Embedded within that would be an A, B, C, D planning process. So we'd look at awareness of what the opportunity would be for the organization. B would be baseline information for it. And we do baseline information just like we would with data analytics for a building. And C is looking for creative solutions. And D is getting down to action. And within that five-level framework and the ABCD planning process, we can have a customized definition of what sustainability is for any organization, and then look at how we make that successful and lay out a plan of implementation for it.
Coming back to Brundtland, which definitely makes sense as a long-term goal of sustainability, how do you reconcile that in the business world with what are usually quarterly objectives? They're not really concerned at the bottom line about future generations. They're concerned about the the shareholders in 3 months' time.
Right. So that usually goes back to the fiduciary responsibility of a company is to meet its shareholder, you know, value in terms of profits for them. And my dog is actually growling, I think, beside me on the floor, because she's probably heard me make this argument too many times. In that the fiduciary responsibility of a firm, when originally created back in the early 1900s, was really looking at creating value for community. And that came back to some lawsuits that were between Ford and General Motors when those two companies were first starting in their early 19-teens. So it's been morphed over time and created a 100-year-old meme that people now see as the fiduciary responsibility of a company is only to create profit. And it's actually wrong. And Delaware law, in which most corporate law has been constituted in the United States, actually says that that is not the case, that we can actually take short-term actions that create less profit if they create long-term value for the corporation. And that's actually part of law. So we can fall back on that and say that we can push back on that meme saying it's only about profits and say there's a whole bunch of other stuff that we are already knowing is important. My students and, you know, business people and analysts have access to 400 to 700 different environmental, social, and financial performance metrics of a firm. And that includes governance even. So if you think no one's watching your publicly traded firm, you'd be wrong. There's a lot of information about any firm out there in terms of how sustainable or maybe how unsustainable that firm is.
I imagine that's even more so today with the ability for people to watch things and if not find direct data, then collate disparate bits of data and make models and make assumptions of what's going on.
Well, absolutely. If I saw, you know, someone from Homestyle Green out doing something that wasn't green, I can take a picture of it with my cell phone, right, and social media and find out within minutes. Same thing with corporations. If they see their people not doing something that they should be doing, or if their products are coming out in some way that's detrimental to people's human health and productivity, then the rest of the world can know about this stuff within minutes nowadays.
So in terms of you've done work with some big corporates, including Ford, but also some other very well-known large companies, and some of these companies have been around for a while. The changes that you're seeing taking place, well, I assume that there are some changes, do you get a sense that that change or a desire to have adopt triple bottom line, look at sustainability, is that coming from a corporate agenda and a shareholder push, or is it coming from a genuine concern for the wider environment at the top level?
Yeah, so I love that question. And if it was a multiple choice question test, I'd say all of the above. So it's coming from shareholders, it's coming from stakeholders, it's coming from management and C-level people or the C-suite within these organizations. So it's nice to see it across the board. Not all companies are at the same level. So when you look at sustainability rankings within industries, you can see some firms are doing better than others. And even when you brought up quarterly reports earlier, you know, if you look at what has happened with some, like Paul Polman at Unilever, he's gone to only annual reports and saying that we don't have to have quarterly reports anymore, and longer term visions of the future are better. More of this is taking place within financial institutions and the financial sector, and trying to look at longer-term value creation and not just short-term myopic, you know, lowest-cost approaches to performance. So we see this with shareholder resolutions. We see it with CEOs and C-suite people. We see it over the last 10 years with more sustainability people being brought on in purposeful sustainability roles or chief sustainability officer, even having that title. But we really think sustainability is part of everyone's job. Everyone has an opportunity to reduce waste and reduce impacts that are negative on the environment or negative on people. And in doing that, employees are champions of change. It can come from the bottom up. But it's usually those companies that are the better ranked ones within an industry sector where we see that more as a top-down approach to it. And sometimes they're actually privately held companies with a strong sustainability value system from the original founders of the company, like Johnson & Johnson, a company like that.
In the real world, who do you see as driving sustainability? Is it coming from policymakers, or are policymakers following business?
Yeah, when I talk to entrepreneurs and others, they say they're not waiting for policymakers. Policymakers are typically behind on some of this stuff, and business people that see opportunities to create a differentiation of their product or their service are the ones that are driving this. And we've seen this across the board in many different ways. And some CEOs have already signed petitions saying that they want a price on carbon dioxide because they know that their processes are better than somebody else in their industry sector, and they want to get rewarded for that. Some work that I even did with our students, January of this year, we presented information to Congress in the states on how a tax on carbon dioxide would impact the state of Pennsylvania. And it would actually increase jobs. It would actually do a whole bunch of positive things. And then some companies would be better able to leverage that to say that, hey, I'm better than that guy down the road who's my competitor. And they want to be able to differentiate in that way.
So a lot of your work has been in supply chain management and processes of systems in large corporations. How does that translate to, or does it translate to, the building industry?
If we look at things like greenhouse gas emissions and those emissions that come from buildings, right, it's an important piece of the overall solution that we need to becoming more sustainable in our practices, from if it's transportation systems or if it's information systems, building systems. They're all interconnected. And where those synergies are going to come from in the future is the multiplicative effects of, you know, the Internet of Things, artificial intelligence, and those systems coming together, so that buildings play a pivotal piece in this. And your listeners probably already know this, and yourself too. When we spend over 90% of our time inside buildings, you know, pre-pandemic, for someone that's 50 years old, that means 45 years of your life have been spent inside a building, be it your home or your office and the place you work. And we want those things to be healthier, high productive spaces that are low energy and better indoor air quality for people. Because why not? Why would we want to suffer through places that aren't good for us and cost a lot more money to run because they're inefficient?
Now, at that level, that totally makes sense for architects, specifiers, engineers, designers, and builders. You know, a man in a van and just in small companies, that they get that stuff. What of your academic research, which is pretty full on in terms of number crunching and literature reviews and some would say quite maybe philosophical? How does some of that translate to the day-to-day operation of a small building company?
Yeah, so you mean a small building company? Do you mean like a small construction company? Okay, so for smaller construction companies, you know, it used to be that to build a building to code would be the lowest cost building you can build here. But what we also realized from this is that building to code is probably the riskiest building you could build, in terms of it's the one that pushes close enough us closer to legal liabilities. You know, it's really not a very efficient building typically here in the States, especially building out of 2x4s and, you know, bad envelopes and things like this. So what a small construction company can do is work with those innovative designers and engineers and architects and others that are in the world that already see the benefits from passive house, from well building, from reset, and go into those spaces with their customers, be it the owners, whoever they're working with, and tell them, you know what? It's such now that we can look at building science and constructing a space for you that can be done at the same cost as code. A couple of years ago, maybe we couldn't say that in terms of the costs were a little bit different. You pay a little bit more upfront for it, but you gain it over the 10, 50 years that building is standing. And now we see costs coming way down, and it's at price parity with building the code. So why not build high performance and try to get as much out of that space as possible and as early as possible when we even think about conceptualize and design those spaces when working with our customers, so that any small company can be a contributing piece of that puzzle that becomes a multiplicative effect for that building to be much better than it could have been otherwise if we just looked at lowest cost.
And in terms of the cost of production, you've done a lot of work in the manufacturing sector and the automobile industry. Do you see some lessons there translating to prefabrication and the manufacture of either building components or whole construction systems?
Yeah, prefab homes and other things that are happening with this. It's even a case study I used to look at with my students was how we could put up at least a lead silver home within 8 hours in prefab, We've got some companies that have started over in Philadelphia, a few hours to the east of us here, that are looking at prefab. So we see lots of opportunities for this in terms of being able to purposely integrate elements of high performance within prefab or within modular approaches to building. And we have some companies here that are doing modular pieces for either envelopes or for some, you know, components of buildings inside. But then we can minimize all the mechanicals and all the things that we need inside these buildings by looking at passive approaches first and really tightening envelopes and getting to much better solutions overall than we had in the past, because we're much better, I guess, equipped with information and with much better products now than we had in the past, so that existing buildings can be renovated and not just knocked down and think building new is the only solution to get to high performance.
I want to come to your recent book, The Power of Existing Buildings. But before I do, let's step back to sustainability and talk about culture, because I'm aware that there's this perception that some cultures, say, for example, Japanese culture, have a much in business, have a much more longer-term view or have done traditionally. Are there some barriers that we have in Western culture and in US business culture, which is similar, to, I think, to Australia, New Zealand, sort of Western mentality? Are there some barriers in the way we operate our businesses and the culture of our businesses to long-term sustainability? And secondly, have you noticed some places around the world that do sustainability better than perhaps the US or Australia, New Zealand?
Yeah, so I think the cultural barriers within the States is that we have an abundance of everything, and therefore we're very wasteful, and we tend not to think about that. If I look at all the energy that we create within the United States on an annual basis, we waste about 67% of that. If you hired 100 new people to start in January for a new business you're creating, at the end of the year you found out 67 of them created mostly hot air or waste, what would you do with it? Right. But yeah, we continue those systems. We use 150-year-old systems to scrape coal out of the earth, burn it, heat water, create steam, turn a turbine, get that out in electric systems to us. And it's really wasteful. And so our transportation systems are also wasteful. We waste about 81% of every gallon of gas that goes into vehicles. And no one seems to think about this. And same thing goes for our homes and our businesses. We can think about first cost and go for the cheapest one, but then not think about those operating costs as it continues over time. So I'm, you know, coming to you today from a net positive home, and I did that after the building was already put up, so the house was already made. I had no design decisions that were made in it, so I looked at after the fact, trying to bring it down with passive solutions, decreasing some of the active systems that are inside it and only using Energy Star systems, generate my electricity with then, you know, renewables after that on top of it, and create a net positive home so I can offload 2 megawatts a year to a vehicle that I can drive 10,000 miles for about $176. And we tend to, in the West, not think about all that goes into that and how much we can already save. Renewables are already cheaper than our utility companies in over 70% of the United States right now. And if I, if I think about, you know, what all is happening in terms of waste, 99% of everything that's created here basically goes to a landfill within 9 months. And we turn to think anything about it. And it's just so shocking to me.
On the plus side, that's really exciting. And I have heard that, and I've read about the fact that solar is starting to overtake coal in terms of just economic sense, which is a game changer, because we can jump up and down, us sort of greenies, as much as we like. But when it makes sense and it's stacking up financially, that's a total game changer.
Yeah, why not save money at the same time? You know, we need to make this easy for people to understand that it's already happening. It's not new. We're not reinventing the wheel. We've been working on this stuff, you know, since 1970, basically, in terms of the renewables. And we're at a price point now where everyone can get access to this. And there's at least 7 different solar companies in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania that can install for people. And we have cloudy days, and we're not, you know, the sunny part of the country. So yeah, everybody should be able to see the potential in this. And if I go back to your question earlier and the word culture that you put in there, and other places in the world that seem to get this, are those countries that are more of maybe the Nordic countries. I was able to spend a sabbatical in Sweden with my family and get to see how people live there. and get to see those homes. We were staying in a home that was built in 1921. Anyway, I looked at the walls and the wall thickness for that thing. It was, I think, between 18 and 21 inches.
Yeah.
Thick, those walls, right? So much, you know, smaller systems needed inside the home to heat or to cool it. It was just a better built structure. And then I come to the States and see stick built homes with 2x4s, basically a couple inches maybe on the outside of that. And it's just a totally different approach to it.
So let's talk about your house, as you brought it up. How old was it originally?
Yeah, so when we got into it, it was about a year and a half old. It was on the market without anybody living on it. They're using it as sort of a showcase home for people in a new development. And when we got to it, we bought a home that's 150% larger than the average home in Pennsylvania. The average home is 2,000 square feet. We're at 3,000 square feet. I was able to bring the home down when looking at my monthly data on it for energy consumptions. We consume 50% less than the average home in Pennsylvania. And we also consume 30% less water than the average home. And when going through it, what did I do? I just tightened the envelope, better sealed the house, did some insulation, sealed off some things in the rim joists and then also the attic, and tried to really just get into some simple things for tightening it that weren't done before. I finished some other elements of the basement and the floors and some other parts of the home that were left open.
You make tightening the envelope sound very simple. That's not necessarily...
Yeah, not the full envelope, just the parts I could get to.
Right. So it wasn't a case of doing a full-on, massive, deep retrofit. It was more just tweaking and doing small improvements.
Yeah, getting some baseline data to start, right? And then going from the baseline data and starting to chip away at that. But yeah, it was only a year and a half old, and we didn't want to strip off the outside of the house to try to do a deep retrofit and put in spray foam insulation, which would have had a much better R factor for it and a much better sealant inside the walls. But I could get above and below the walls because where the attic was situated. And I could actually see if I was getting a lot of chimney effect and air moving between, you know, the walls by how much was coming through the insulation on the top and how dirty it was. And then go back to those places and try to plug them and seal it off better.
The way you were describing originally, I was expecting you to say that it was a 1920s red brick house. So that's amazing. And it's also totally transferable. And I see and hear this pretty often, too often, that people are moving into a house that's less than 10 years old. Mm. And in our case, yeah, it might have condensation on the inside. It's cold, it's expensive to heat. It's cold. It's drafty. And it's, you're right. These houses are just, they're built to code, and the developers then just moved on and built the next lot of them. So to know that that's happening elsewhere is a little bit concerning, but also comforting in how easily it's been for you to transform that into something that is drastically different by the sound of it.
Yeah, when we first moved in, you know, we could feel air moving across our feet on the first floor of the home. And then as we started looking into it, I had a blower door test done on the home to see how leaky it was. I started looking at, we have two fireplaces in it that are natural gas based. But they left 7-inch diameter holes in the side of the house for the exhaust for that. And we found air was just going back and forth through it. So it was about a point where I could use chimney socks and, you know, stop that. I could get underneath those chimneys and actually, or the fireplace inserts, and actually insulate and better block that so that I can get air exchange underneath it or around it. When we did that, we could find immediate effects of comfort, and you could just feel it was different. So, yeah, there are some things that I might say are easier than others, right? I don't want to make this too simple because there are some things that were more involved, and getting the blower door test done was really nice. That was provided by my utility company at no charge. So then I could have that company come out and tell me what the opportunities were. We could actually go around the house with an infrared camera, take pictures of things that were leaking and where we thought we could have bigger improvements, and then try to tackle some of those things one at a time.
It sounds like your house has benefited from being owned by someone who is passionate, but also well-educated and also resourceful. If you had your consulting hat on, your academic hat, and you were talking to a construction company about the opportunities, or maybe a new startup on how to fix other houses of in a similar situation, what would you recommend as a business model for getting houses to a more appropriate state, so they're not found by just regular people in the state that you originally found it?
Yeah, so I think that kind of comes to me in a couple different ways, but one of them would be to try to create synergy and hubs of other service providers. So if you're a construction company, you know, hook up with some people that are some realtors, maybe even hook up with those that are involved with some of the banks. And we've had a green banking initiative kind of going too, with trying to educate realtors about how to get more efficient homes on the marketplace and sell them in a way that's different than less efficient homes. So you can find networks of others to create synergies with. So my home was part of a 20 home development here. And if you look at that real estate development company and others like it, when they start new projects, you know, seeking them out to try to get on their radar in advance of a new development. And then also saying that you come into the space, not just as yourself as a XYZ company with your own services, but you'll bring with it some others that you have relationships with, and that all of you can tackle different elements of the home. And that maybe you can provide a bundle of services when doing this, instead of just competing typically on lowest cost for only one service and a host of other service providers within that same development opportunity. So we see some of this happening locally with some passive house players that are trying to get into that space and say that, you know, we come in better than somebody else who's just a traditional construction company because we're more knowledgeable about building sciences and how to create spaces that are actually healthier for people and cost less to operate. And that provides a different value proposition as a company than would somebody else who's coming up through the traditional ranks.
And are there opportunities for businesses? Is there a business model for helping to retrofit existing houses? Because that's the bulk of the problem that we have, are all those houses that are out there that are consuming too much. Do you see a viable business model for helping homeowners of less than optimal houses?
Yeah, absolutely. And we've got a couple of different people here in the area trying to do some startups around this in the last 2 years and also kind of create hubs for this. We have a really strong Green Building Alliance here that was one of the first kind of USGBC locations within the States. And it's morphed, and they're also connected to a lot of people here that are really passionate about doing this for existing homes. So if I also look at things that are taking place that are sort of policy oriented, back to one of your earlier questions, the Green New Deal in New York City has been put forth and passed to say that they're going to look at low energy homes and buildings within the New York metropolitan area. And those aren't your traditional homes. You know, like we have a lot of home stock in Pittsburgh that's from the 1960s and 70s. But even in New York, they're looking at retrofitting 50,000 buildings and bring them down to low energy consumption, low greenhouse gas emissions, and low cost to operate then afterwards. And those same things can happen for any place around here. One of the websites I've also sent my students and others to is something called greenandsave.com. And they have a master ROI table on the site, and they take you through about 60 to 70 different options that you can use in your own home to bring down the cost of it and to make it more energy efficient. And it's, you know, programmable thermostats to solar powered ventilation systems for your attic, and even into some mini retrofits of portions of the home. So there's a lot of information out there to glean from this. So I think homeowners should take some time to figure that out and really look into the cost savings that they can find from doing this, because I've got some neighbors that spend hundreds of dollars a month on their utility bills. And right now, our utility bill's $15 a month for a connection fee.
Yeah. And how do you have a sense of how much it costs you to get to that point? You know, what's the return on investment?
Yeah. So that master ROI table is nice in that it actually gives you the return on investment. They use a 10-year timeline for it. So most of the things there all will have an ROI or a payback. My own research, also working with the School of Architecture at Carnegie Mellon University just down the road from us, we looked at life cycle assessment and energy consumption of buildings within an Asian context, a European context, and then also the States, and really found that the ROI to begin with is pretty good. If I use something like a lighting retrofit, it might be, you know, a 5-year payback for something if I go to all LEDs. And if I look at that with the environmental impacts avoided, that 5-year ROI comes down to about 3.5 years. And then if I also add to that the human health and productivity opportunities that this provides, that ROI can come down to 4 months in terms of a payback. So what we're really finding is that the paybacks for the human health and productivity parts of this are 10 times greater than the financials. And the financials are phenomenal to begin with. And then I actually, every year I task my business students, my graduate students, with looking at this themselves. So I open up our Rockwell Hall, our business school, and actually give them a design competition to make it a low energy building. I give them an unlimited budget. It's 169,000 square foot building. It's over 50 years old, and it represents more than 4 million buildings in the United States, to try to say that if we do it here, we can do it anywhere. And they come up with their own plans to get to a net zero energy building.
That's very exciting. Now, did the book come after your renovation? This is the power of existing buildings, which you co-authored with a couple of other construction experts.
Yeah, so Aros Group is the co-authors with this. So Craig Stevenson and Beth Eckenridge, and they're both at Aros Group right now. They do a lot of work with indoor air quality. Craig Stevenson came out of the construction industry with 20 years experience there. He was also an alum of our business school. So it was a really interesting collaboration where he was a speaker that I had in class before that helped with that design competition. As I would bring in judges, he would be one of the judges with architects, construction people, and even some engineers, you know, looking at assessing the team's proposals for what they're going to do with the school and Rockwell Hall. So that collaborative kind of grew into the opportunity for this book. So the home kind of came in pieces along the way. And then what we did with Rockwell Hall is we've also then invested in the building. We put meters on the utilities. We put indoor air quality sensors inside it. And we now have a dashboard. And I just wrote a paper on this in the Journal of Management Education about using business schools as learning labs, so that when someone walks into our business school, you can now see a dashboard that tells you what the CO2 emissions are in real time for the building, our energy consumption, water, and indoor air quality. And what we've been finding is that our air quality inside the building is 2 to 3 times better than stepping outside the building.
Wow. That's very impressive.
Cool. Yeah, I love having conversations with people then afterwards about why. You know, why is a great question. And then you can tell them all about the building science, everything that's happened, the region that we're in, and all the outdoor air quality issues that are all over the world. And I can even pull up things on my smartphone. You can get apps now that actually show you the air quality and its movement around the world. So you can go to things like Air Visual and use their app, and I can actually see the air quality around my home, around the city. And then I can actually see air quality moving globally, like weather moves.
Yeah. And I think that there's so much power in those dashboards for telling people what's going on, encouraging them to improve things that they do have control over. But they also get people aware of the relevant metrics. And I think the more people start to see baseline CO2 levels of a building, even just seeing temperature rather than it just being a tiny dial tucked away over on the wall, if you can see that in front of you, then I think it just makes people more aware of what's comfortable and what's productive in an internal environment and what's not. And it gives some numbers to it.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head with that one. Some studies out of Oxford or Cambridge actually looked at giving people real-time data from dashboards and what that would do inside buildings. Real-time data allowed them to reduce energy consumption by about 50%. When they looked at getting that data maybe once a week or once a month, it was reducing maybe a little by 10%. So the better we can put data in front of people, the better they can interact with those spaces and think about how they can contribute to reducing impacts or reducing energy consumption. And then, you know, get to how an existing building can be a place in which we can actually learn inside it while better managing that space and that place for us to be productive in.
Robert, we're just about out of time, but you've got a huge amount of research that you've done in the past. You've got some great programs. You've run countless courses. What's your and you sound pretty positive, I have to say. what's your outlook? Where do you think things are going to go, not just in the building sector, but globally over the next, say, 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, I love that question. I love looking out like that, because to build on, you know, from where we are now to where we need to get. I love working with my graduate students in a business school. It's one of the top rated programs in the world for the integration of sustainability into a business program, because I can work with innovative young people and think about how they're going to become the change agents for the world, so that when they're out in the next 5 or 10 years, they can make better decisions that give us a more sustainable environment in which we can live, work, or play, and be part of the change that we need to drive this forward. So I do tend to be optimistic about this. It may depend on the day and what's happening around me. But I also know that people can do this in their homes, with everything they purchase, with any car they drive. And I see these synergies of systems coming where we enable the Internet of Things, artificial intelligence, and those buildings that are out there that already exist to then become intersection hubs. You know, one of the largest owners of parking lots in the world is a cloud company. And what they see happening in the future is that there'll be fewer cars in cities because people are going to have to pay more to drive those cars themselves. Autonomous vehicle, safer. And then we can also, when we get dropped off at work, our autonomous vehicle can be out moving around, creating value for us and moving other things around. And they've bought all these parking lots because they see these buildings in the future being hubs where food can be grown, where it can be prepackaged, and we can actually send out grocery orders and cars can go pick up things for us and have prepackaged food, pre-made meals sometimes. And instead of being in a restaurant where people would sit down in, you can have that food delivered to you in, like, by Grubhub or whatever it might be now, but at a much larger scale in the future. So buildings become opportunities for food, and food and transportation intermingle and intersect. And even here in Pittsburgh, we've had over $1 billion poured into the city to research autonomous driving, and at the same time created a three-dimensional grid system above the city for drones at the same time. So all of a sudden, we're going to see this intersection of transportation, logistics, buildings, food, health for people also, and just getting out and doing things differently, coming together in the future. So in the next 5 and 10 years, I see a huge movement towards companies better relaying a story about how they contribute to sustainability and how they meet maybe one of the 17 sustainable development goals or maybe multiple goals. And that's the nice thing about buildings, right? In terms of buildings already do this, they tend to meet, was it 1, 2, 3, 4, I'm trying to think, 7 or 8 of the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, and that they help us with good health and well-being, quality education. And they can actually help us in terms of moving towards a more sustainable society. And that involves then the time that we spend, you know, 90% of our time inside can also be moved towards responsible consumption and production, climate action, life on land, partnerships and goals. So these are the actual, you know, sustainable development goals as they help us understand how we can have buildings be key components to the systems that intersect to make a sustainable future for us. And that is something that was released in 2015. It was at the United Nations with Ban Ki-moon when those were released. And it's something that we can all look at it and say, you know what, I'd rather contribute to those things than do something that's detrimental to those goals. And this is where I see things going in the next 5 or 10 years with systems colliding in a way that makes things so much better for us and more integrated.
Thank you very much for your time today, Robert. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Matthew, it's been my pleasure entirely. One of the things I told you early on was that my students are tasked to go out and find interesting places for information. And this is where your podcast has come up with this. So I was so happy to see the Homestyle Green entity out there in the world trying to deliver information to people so that way we can move this performance frontier farther and faster out into the future and have healthier spaces for all of us to work and play in.
Dr. Robert Schrauf there of Duquesne University in Pittsburgh. Fascinating interview. I really enjoyed that chat, and I'd love to get your thoughts on it as well. Please do email me, send me your comments, questions, feedback, matthew@homestylegreen.com. If you do enjoy the show, love it if you could give us a rating and review, and also tell your friends, tell your colleagues about the show and help spread the word. And while you're subscribing to podcasts, don't forget to check out the Passive House podcast, which is put together by the team at the Passive House Accelerator. That's a relatively new, we're up to episode number 11 or 12 by the time this comes out. And it's a show that I co-host with Zach Semke from the Passive House Accelerator. And make sure you subscribe to all the great stuff that's coming out at the Accelerator. Just go and have a look, passivehouseaccelerator.com. That's it for me for this week. Hope you enjoyed the show. And we'll catch you again with some more interviews coming up in the next few weeks. Bye for now.